Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, David Cameron's hoping Boris Johnson delivers the Tories some good news this evening. According to early indications, Mr Johnson is ahead of Labour rival Ken Livingstone in the race for London Mayor. The PM's lost more than 410 seats in the local English and Welsh elections, while Labour have made gains of over 760. The Lib Dems have lost 320 councillors. Earlier, David Cameron apologised.
I'm sorry for the hard-working Conservative councillors who've lost their seats, obviously against a difficult national backdrop. These are difficult times and there aren't easy answers. What we have to do is take the difficult decisions to deal with the debt, the deficit and the broken economy that we inherited.
A soldier has died at the Castle Martin military firing ranges in Pembrokeshire. It happened on Wednesday. He's been named by the Ministry of Defence as Ranger Michael Maguire. The Prime Minister and seven other Cabinet Ministers will be allowed to see documents and witness statements before they're presented at the Leveson inquiry. Ministers argued there was a clear public interest in being granted the access, as they'll be responsible for acting on the inquiry's recommendations. Lord Leveson granted the status at the Royal Courts of Justice.
There can be no question of access being sought for the purpose of preparing evidence. I grant their applications. They will collectively be known as Government Corps participants.
The agency behind a controversial TV ad which shows an Argentinian Olympic hopeful training in the Falklands has condemned it. Young and Rubicam say they'd asked the Argentinian government to pull the spot.
Bristol Community FM.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. After the 6 o'clock news, was peddling the WMD lie, then sacking the journalist and then the Director General just business as usual at the BBC? We travel through the years and trace a series of facts that shows the BBC establishment and big business bias as it veers ever further away from its so-called public service remit. We look too at what you can do if you complain to the BBC and get nowhere. We're joined by Neil Worry, who refused to pay his licence fee and runs a blog called Biased BBC from his home in Somerset. Plus, tomorrow's March for the NHS. Keith Evans is here from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight's lows of 6 Celsius and dry. The bank holiday weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some light showers and sunny spells. The sunniest day will be Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, some heavy showers on Tuesday and Wednesday, sunnier at the end of the week. And next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of May, highs of 13 Celsius. Come on, spring. Sunny spells and showers. That's next weekend, the 12th and 13th of May. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining us for with this week's news review is Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, can you tell us, you've been down at the mayoral count. First of all, I suppose the most fundamental question is, why did we have to wait until this morning to start counting the votes?
Good question, and one I actually do want to ask, because there were two cities that didn't have other local elections, Bristol and Nottingham. Nottingham counted overnight and declared around about 1:30 this morning. So I'm not clear, I wasn't party to the decision, and I'll be seeking to find out, because it did seem a little odd.
Yeah, because I mean, you've got a situation where all the ballot boxes are sealed, everyone finishes voting, and then they're left overnight for, I suppose, 10 o'clock, 11, 12, and then until 10 o'clock in the morning. That's 12, 13, 14 hours. This is a security risk, surely. You know, an election is quite a serious matter. You can't leave the ballot boxes just sitting around waiting. Why not get on with the count immediately?
Well, boxes are sealed and they're kept under guard. As I say, I don't know why the decision was taken to go with a morning count. It could have been a number of reasons, but I can see that had the turnout been high, which of course it wasn't, then that could have caused some logistical issues. But I never expected the turnout to be any higher than a normal local election. In fact, it was considerably lower.
Tell us about the normal turnout. What would you expect in a local election, and what did we get today?
Local election turnouts in Bristol over recent years, they've hovered around the sort of 40% mark, and it varies from place to place, but usually somewhere between 30 and 50%, with an average across the city of usually somewhere around the high 30s. This ballot had a 24% turnout.
Okay, so why is that, do you think?
I think the main reason is that we didn't have any other local elections, so the level of political engagement was much lower. And I also think for a lot of people who were unsure about this, or felt that, oh, I don't know, I'm not sure this will be a change or not that I want to get involved in, just didn't turn out. And I think it was predictable. I think we were always predicting that a referendum with nothing else going on at the same time would be a low turnout. I think that was the experience with the alternative vote referendum in places that didn't have elections last year. And it comes from central government treating all the cities as one, imposing this referendum on everyone, and imposing it on a particular timescale. If they delayed Bristol's for another year, then we could have coincided it with local elections.
Well, one of the things that's been fascinating to watch over the last few weeks is the Bristol Evening Post, now called The Post, of course, and their coverage
five
of all this.
Five Mornings Post, perhaps.
The Five Mornings Post, yeah, maybe. And their coverage of this, because that, you know, one of the things that I found fascinating is that there's been some very sort of, well, I would say, sort of fairly trite articles which are going into personalities rather than into how the mayor, a new mayor, will affect the city. Or would affect the city as it was. And actually some of the most interesting stuff has been in the letters pages. One of the letters on Wednesday this week was explaining how actually the government has apparently said that we're not actually 100% sure what the powers of the mayor will be. So how can you actually have a referendum when you're not actually sure what the mayor's powers will be? And I think that there's been a sort of a gap here between what we're voting for at yes or no for a mayor and what the mayor's powers are actually going to be, what the difference is going to be in reality.
I think that's right. There's a huge gap. I was talking to somebody actually at football last week, and I said, well, look, it'd be rather like on your way in, somebody offers to sell you a raffle ticket. You know what the price is. You don't know what the prize is or when it will be delivered or whether it will be delivered at all. But, you know, cough up your money for this raffle ticket. And that's essentially where we've been with it. Government keeps saying, well, there might be some extra funds. There might be some extra powers. But in reality, we've got no substance. And I think this is part of the difficulty that, once again, we've got this Whitehall Westminster stranglehold over our politics. It is prepared to sort of dib things out on a, you know, in return for people bidding for money and that sort of thing. And, you know, from what I've seen of this, this has been going on. This isn't this government. The last government did it as well. And I think what you end up with is a massive job creation scheme for lawyers and accountants, because, you know, to get a bid watertight, you have to have lawyers and accountants write it, and then you have to have lawyers and accountants the other end interpreting it and so on. And I just think, actually, wouldn't it be far better if we agreed a constitutional settlement between what is central government and what is local government's responsibility, and local government just left to get on with it?
Yeah, well, that would be nice. Is there any way we can sort of elbow Westminster out a little bit and sort of kick them down the other end of the park, Steve?
Well, I think, you know, they have promised powers in mayoral areas, so now we've got this yes vote, then I think we need to say, well, okay, as Walter Mondale once said in an election, where's the beef? And start demanding things and see what happens. I feel that the, you know, centralising culture of Whitehall will make that very difficult. I've been involved in the local government association on behalf of my party for a while, and I remember having one really laughable discussion in the DCLG Communities and Local Government Department headquarters about salary statements and declaring what people are paid and pay policy and so on. And, you know, they wanted to impose a remuneration committee on us. And I said, well, in Bristol, we've already got a human resources committee. Why do we want another committee, you know, with different people on it discussing the same issues? But I think this is a problem. They tend to look from London and think there's a one-size-fits-all solution, and there often isn't to local issues.
Well, we're in a situation where now we've decided that there will be a mayor in the city. The election's to be later in the year. But this is not going to help, is it, with actually getting people engaged politically in the city? Because what we hear is that the mayor will actually be taking powers away from ordinary councillors, so there's less incentive on people to vote in the local elections.
Well, I think that is a danger. And one of the problems you've got with the mayors we've already got in those cities that have already made this change is that in some places mayors do work well with elected councillors, and in others they simply don't. And you have gridlock. You have North Tyneside, where the mayor is a Conservative, most of the rest of the council is Labour, and she can't get her budget through. So this isn't a panacea. A lot of the Yes campaigners were saying, oh, if we had a mayor, they'd be able to do things, and, you know, they'd be able to wave magic wands and spend lots of money and everything would be fine. Well, it isn't the case. And some of the things they've been most critical of, like transport and the arena, football stadiums and so on, are not within the mayor's power, even if you've got a mayor. So I think there's been a lot of misinformation and a lot of people trying to claim that there are powers and influence that aren't there. So I think you're right. It will potentially centralise power much more, and I don't think that's a particularly good move. And the difficulty with the legislation is that we don't have the ability to change it if it goes wrong.
What about what we're hearing is that the council is too bureaucratic, Steve. What the mayor will do is cut through the bureaucracy at last.
What I worry about is that actually a mayor will actually bring more bureaucracy in, because what tends to happen when you get a mayor elected, they want a deputy, they then want their own policy advisers, and if we end up with a situation, it partly depends on the attitude of any incoming mayor. If they're prepared to say, well, okay, I'm looking towards the future and what's happening now, fine. If they say, well, I want to revisit every policy and every strategic decision that's already been made, then we will have a recipe for inertia as things that have already been agreed and progressed are put on the back burner while somebody has another look at it. So I don't see them cutting a swathe through bureaucracy. I think a lot of that's already happened. I got elected to the council in 2005 and there were 8 chief officers. There's now 4. So a lot of that streamlining is already going on, and that will happen whether or not there's a mayor.
Well, I voted in St Paul's yesterday evening quite late, and they were saying there that it looked like it was around about 11% turnout. Now, is this really a mandate for this change?
Well, it is, because that's what the legislation gives you. But, I mean, I think it's a pretty half-hearted mandate, because, you know, it looks like with a 24% turnout, roughly 13% of the electorate have decided they want this change. And so there you are. It's forced on us. We have the election in November, and so on. So I think it's a bit of a flawed mandate, and it's certainly, I mean, the one thing that's been very clear to me is earlier on in this debate, there was a view that, oh well, you know, this will excite people and people will be really enthusiastic about this change and want to go for an elected mayor and it'll all be wonderful. In actual fact, you know, the level of enthusiasm for this is very low. Having said that, the legislation is as it is. There's no threshold. And, you know, half of a 24%, a bit over half of a 24% turnout is enough to make the change. So, I mean, I'm a Democrat. I accept that. Except that's where the legislation takes us. Doesn't mean I like it, but then, you know, I'm afraid we do have to move on in politics.
Okay, so let's cut to the chase. What changes are we going to see at the end of the year, at Christmas, by the time we've got this mayor? What do we actually know about what powers the mayor will have?
Right, what we do know is that the mayor will have all the powers of the leader of council and cabinet. They will be able
and the cabinet
and
too.
Cabinet, yes, they will be able to appoint a cabinet, which is must be councillors, must be elected councillors in their cabinet.
Oh right, so they can't just appoint any old person
no.
in there.
I mean,
right?
they can
like the House of Lords or something.
No, we're not quite gone to that stage yet. They will be able to appoint their own advisors, though, and that's certainly, and they're usually fairly highly paid. I mean, that's certainly the experience in London and other cities.
And is that cabinet going to have to be proportional to the number of councillors from the different parties, or can they just pick anyone?
Well, in theory, they can pick anyone. Now, there may be some party discipline that comes into play here as to whether parties are prepared to accept nomination. But, yes, they can pick people from one party or from all parties. And that's a mayoral decision. Obviously, you can pick someone. Whether they accept the nomination is a thing. But yeah, it's a change in the. I mean, technically, a leader of council can do that. They can pick their cabinet. Although what tends to happen under the party system is that certainly in two of the three major parties, the group elects their nominees for front bench posts, and then the leader allocates portfolios. Not sure the Conservatives do that, but then they haven't been in that position.
So you're saying we could actually see a Green in the cabinet?
Could see a Green, a Conservative, Labour. You know, they could decide to go for a rainbow cabinet, quite possibly. Now, again, it would be up to people and up to their party group decisions as to whether they accepted that sort of nomination. But yeah, in theory, they could do. It's entirely up to them. And the experience in some places is that mayors go for a single party cabinet, and in other places they pick from more than one party. So yes, that could change things. But what will happen is, obviously, coming out of our annual meeting on the 15th of May, there will be a leader in cabinet appointed. But essentially, they'll be there for half a year. I mean, the timing is peculiar, because the budget planning process usually starts in the autumn, and budget has to go to council by, I think, the end of February. So a mayor will come into office partway through the budget cycle. This hasn't been thought through at all. It's incredibly messy.
Okay. Yes. So your party is the ruling party in the city at the moment. Barbara Jenk has said that she's stepping down as leader. What's the procedure then for electing a new leader? I imagine that will be at any time now.
Well, nominations are open now, and I believe they close tomorrow. And any member of the group can either self-nominate or be nominated, and there will then be an election by secret ballot at our group meeting on Tuesday night.
Oh, so the suggestion is that Barbara was very much part of the no camp, and the suggestion is that the reason she stepped down is because of that, that there is actually some, you know, forces at work behind the scenes that want a mayor that don't think that it's appropriate to have someone from the no camp leading Bristol in the run-up to these actual mayoral election later in the year.
I don't think it is that. I think Barbara's decision to stand down was for the personal reasons that she declared. Having said that, I think there were elements within the Yes campaign that were clear on their Facebook site. I mean, some of us used to debate with them on their Facebook site, and we all got thrown off on about Monday, Tuesday of the week. But I mean, there were elements within the Yes campaign who were wanting to make the last week's final push very much about, well, you know, get rid of the Lib Dems, get rid of Barbara Jenk. So whether that influenced the timing of her announcement, I don't know. I think the decision, I know from talking to others, has been something that she has been looking at for some period of time. So I don't think it's that. But whether the announcement was brought forward a week or so, I'm not privy to that. But I can see that that is possible. But in reality, it wouldn't have affected the decision, I don't think.
What about the characteristics then of the No campaign and the Yes campaign? And you were a No campaigner.
Yes.
I mean, you're obviously going to say we were a very upright, upstanding bunch, and they were scallywags. But what are the actual
characteristics? I wouldn't say that, actually, Tony.
No?
I think a lot of the Yes campaign were actually, you know, actually very nice, well-meaning people. Who genuinely thought that you know, electing a mayor could sort of cut a swathe through and solve what they perceive as a number of problems. I think there's a certain naivety that was actually quite endearing about some of them. Others, I think, you know, were definitely politically motivated to saw this as a you know, a fast way of getting the Labour Party into a position of influence in the city. But I don't think that's the majority. I think the majority were genuinely quite well-meaning and believed what they were being told by ministers about additional powers and funding. Some of us who've been around the political game for a while are always wary of government ministers bearing gifts.
Well, we've had George Osborne and David Cameron recently in the city. We've also had, you know, the business community really throwing its weight behind the mayor, the Yes campaign for the mayor. And what does that tell us about, you know, I mean, for example, we have an article in the Post this week. I'll save £3 million in 1 year if elected mayor. This is George Ferguson. Now, it seems to me the business community, this is very much their chosen candidate for the campaign. I mean, I know there's been articles in the paper and stuff in the press over the last probably 5, 6, 7 years saying, oh, George should be our mayor. And of course, he's almost like he's the anointed one. So ultimately, I mean, he's also, the other thing is, in none of the articles in the Post about George does it actually say that he's a merchant venturer, which he is. I mean, he's been on this programme and admitted that, you know, maybe he's being slightly used by the merchant adventurers as a sort of public relations type, you know, a good guy, whereas actually the merchant venturers are associated with, you know, massive amounts of wealth, the 1%, if you want, and also, of course, historically with slavery.
Yes, that's right. I mean, obviously not in modern times, but, you know, they were a trading body, and we know what the trade was in Bristol in those former times. I think one of the things that has actually surprised me about the business people's support for a mayor is that there was no sign of any well-funded Yes campaign. And that was one of the strange things. It was almost, you know, for the first couple of weeks, it was almost a bit like a phony war. And I thought, well, if all these business people with lots of money are so keen, then, you know, I'm surprised they weren't, you know, splashing out money on paying for leaflets and adverts in the paper and all the rest of it in the run-up to the campaign starting. Because I think if they did that, they'd have had a head start on us. But, you know, it seemed like they were scratching around for money and asking for small donations, same as we were, which was a bit of a surprise. So, I don't know. I often get the impression with some of the people who profess to speak for business in this city that actually what they want is a sort of seat at the top table and influence, but they're not prepared to put in the hard graft that's necessary to get involved in a political process. So it's almost like they're, you know, they're looking for some sort of fast track of influence. And, you know, I could go into the Churchillian quote, I think it was, about Beaverbrook in the 20s about power without responsibility, but, you know, there seems to be an element of that within some of the business community in Bristol. But business-wise, you know, Bristol is successful. We're, when you look at the indicators of multiple deprivation and unemployment and so on, yeah, we're struggling, but we're doing much better than most other cities, and we've got the enterprise zone coming on stream and so on. You know, I think our future is good. So I don't really know what problem business wants to solve, and I'm not sure they do either.
Well, it might solve the problem, for example, as they see it, of the Ashton Gate move of the Ashton Gate Stadium, for example, and the trouble that they've had getting their planning permission. This is the sort of thing, and the arena project. This is one of these are the sorts of big, high-profile projects which maybe are controversial in planning terms and in, you know, going through the planning system, that maybe the business community want to see someone like George is in there, or you know, whoever else it happens to be, to really be to look after their interests. They get very angry, really, with the fact that there is so much planning bureaucracy. Certainly, in Stephen Lansdowne's view, he owns the land. He should be able to do what he wants with it.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, you know, the reality is it's nothing to do with planning. He got his planning permission from the City Council. He got his planning permission for the redevelopment of Ashton Gate in order to fund part of it. The problem he ran up against was town green legislation. And where that goes, well, that's not currently within the competence of the local authority to change. Now, you know, we've argued as Bristol that actually maybe that should be, and that having lots of highly paid inspectors sifting through evidence might not be the most efficient way to work, but that's the system we're in at the moment. As far as the arena's concerned, that was a regional development agency project, and they pulled the plug. Now, that land is still available, but without that sort of essentially central government funding, then operators are not prepared to take the risk. Arena operators are interested in coming to Bristol, but they want to operate something that's there. So the problem is, how do you fund the £10-12 million in order to put the thing in place? And, you know, unless the private sector are going to say, well, you know, here's your cheque, go and do it, and I don't see them falling over themselves to do that, then, you know, just ranting about it isn't going to make it happen.
Well, going back to today's Yes result for the referendum to have an elected mayor, what are your thoughts about the actual majority? I mean, what sort of majority, and how many people roughly voted, and what percentage was it that was in favour other than behind?
Yeah, around 75,000 voted, and the yes had something over 41,000. No, so it must be 76,000. No, just under 36,000. So it's of that sort of level. So I imagine that's probably, I haven't done the
maths.
It's about 5,000 majority.
It's about a 5,000 majority, so it's about a 52-48 in percentage terms.
Yeah, okay.
Which is what I always thought. I always thought it would go through by that sort of margin, one way or the other. Unfortunately, it was the wrong way.
And what about, because this is another thing that bothers me. I mean, we had a whole load of stuff in The Independent over the last few weeks about postal votes and the dangers of postal votes, the fact that it's very easy to forge them. And this has been certainly in Birmingham in the past.
Yes.
You know, there have been court cases of people who have been prosecuted for electoral fraud. One of the things that bothers me is the fact that going back to the fact that the count was the boxes are left overnight, is that they weren't. It's not only that they were left overnight, but they were actually left at the Ashton Gate Stadium overnight, which isn't even council property. You know what is going on when surely there are questions, security questions, about allowing someone who obviously has a very big interest in the city, a very rich person, a rich organisation, a private organisation, being part of safeguarding our elections. Certainly in the US, there are films of people going into places where votes are being stored late at night and fiddling around with the results and actually fraudulent, you know, but the potential for fraud.
And voting machines and so on. I'm fairly convinced that I don't think there was fraud in this one. But I mean, you're right that it does lead to questions. I don't know why it couldn't have been counted in the council house. I don't know why we had to hire a private venue for it.
What would we spend out for it? I mean, this is money.
I'm intending to ask the acting chair of Elections and Democracy Committee those very questions. You know, why was it overnight? Why do we have to use Ashton Gate? Why do we have the big count centre and so on? Whereas, you know, in previous elections, like Euro elections and so on, we've been able to count, which are of a similar scale, we've been able to operate that quite happily, either in remote polling stations or at the council house. So I don't know. I'm going to be asking some of these questions because I just wonder whether we're perhaps over-egging what we needed to do. Yes, I mean, I think there are some questions there.
Okay, now, just generally the position of the Liberal Democrats. A couple of weeks ago, George Galloway was really taking a pot shot at the Lib Dems on Question Time. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about your party.
Yeah.
George Galloway.
Well, you don't have to be a pasty-eating granny with a caravan to conclude that this has been a disastrous budget. Few budgets survive the publicity of the day after. But this one has been cataclysmic. It has been omni-shambolic. And we've seen it here. These two people, in case you didn't know, are in the same government together. In fact, they don't agree, apparently, on very much. But, Tim, you're a very impressive fellow, much more impressive than Nick Clegg. I don't know why they don't replace him with you.
Don't be naughty.
But you're committing electoral suicide, keeping this lot in power with a budget like that. Because the whole country can see this is a government of 23 millionaires out of 29 in the cabinet, people who are so filthy rich that they don't even know their wealth. George Osborne thought that he was not paying the higher rate of tax. If he isn't, he ought to be behind bars, because his income, as can be easily discerned, is upper tax bracket income. This rich man's government is being kept in power by you. If not for you, they'd be out.
That's not true, is it?
Why don't you look at your own interest? No. You lost your deposit in Bradford. You're losing your deposit all over the country. You're going to be annihilated at the next general election. Get out of bed, metaphorically speaking, with these people.
George,
do yourselves a favour.
That was George Galloway speaking a couple of weeks ago on Question Time. And there have been certainly some calls and questions, anyway, over whether Nick Clegg is really fit to carry the Liberal Democrat Party into next year's local elections, let alone to carry on as the Deputy Prime Minister. What are your thoughts about that, Steve?
Well, I think the leader of the party has to have the Deputy Prime Minister role in a coalition government. And I don't see the problem with necessarily being Nick Clegg. And one of the difficulties is actually getting people in England, and I think it is England rather than Scotland and Wales, because they're more used to this, used to the idea of coalition governments, and that you can have two parties who are natural opponents, as Conservatives and Liberals have always been, who can cooperate when the electoral arithmetic demands. There's been a lot of good things about this budget, and I don't think it's an omni-shambles, actually. I think some of the presentation and some of the leaking in advance was a bit stupid. But, you know, we've raised tax allowances, and we're on target to get to 10,000 tax allowance earlier. Now, I mean, I have a daughter who's a low-paid worker, and I know I represent lots of people who are. That's a powerful incentive to say that, you know, we're taking people out of tax. Things like the pasty tax. I mean, yeah, it's a great photo opportunity to have, you know, people like Waitrell Weaves and Ed Miliband, who probably never been in a branch of Greggs in their lives. You know, the sort of culture of middle classes condescending to go in and buy a pasty.
But well, I don't think David Cameron or Jules Osborne.
Well, exactly,
either.
And you know, it's all a bit false, isn't it? But I mean, you know, but in reality, I find it. I've always found it odd. Some of the regulations around around VAT. I did work in it for a while, but you know, why a hot pasty was considered different to a hot burger or a hot fish and chips, you know, to me is silly, and I think it's right to actually tidy up the loophole.
But going back to Nick Clegg, though, I mean, many people see him as toadying up to David Cameron in a way that someone like Charles Kennedy would never have done. I mean, but you know, Charles Kennedy would have got more bangs for your buck, surely, in Downing Street.
I'm not sure, because the coalition agreement wasn't just Nick Clegg. It was negotiated by teams of people on both sides. And I think the team on the Lib Dem side, if I'm not mistaken, was Nick Clegg, Chris Hughne, David Laws and Danny Alexander. So you've got some big hitters in there. So, I mean, I think the coalition agreement that they got was the best achievable. Where I do have some criticism is I think... on some policies, and elected mayors are one, I think we've gone along with things that actually we should have distanced ourselves from. They would probably have had to happen anyway, because they were clearly Conservative priorities. But I think we could have put some clear water in there. We've done that with the NHS bill. We've managed to get that amended. And I think on some other issues, we have some people who are taking a very firm line. For instance, on Lords reform, there is an element of the Conservative Party who has never been interested, and not for more than 100 years, ever been interested in democratising the House of Lords. And people like Lord Oakeshott have made it very clear that well, if we don't get Lords reform, then we're not having the constituency boundary changes,
I mean,
either.
Surely it's Commons reform we need, not Lords reform. I mean, you know, the House of Lords has been a tempering influence on some of the more extreme ideas. For example, for the first time ever in British history, we're talking now about the criminalisation of squatting. That is to say, someone is trying to put a roof over their head, and that suddenly they're in jail, making money possibly for some private prison company. So, you know, ultimately, Clegg holds the balance of power, but he's not using it.
Well, I think we are using it, and we don't exclusively hold the balance of power. You only hold the balance of power if you plus another party, or Party A and you plus Party B equal a majority, and that's not the electoral arithmetic that the 2010 election threw up. It was clear that you know, Lib Dem plus Labour was not a majority in Parliament. Lib Dem plus Tories were, and I think that's where we came in. I think we do need to make sure that in the second half of the Parliament it's very clear what are Liberal Democrat priorities. You know, the Green Deal is another one, for instance. And
what's that?
This is the investment programme on things like home insulation and so on. Full details are due to come out later in the year.
Is this the Green Investment Bank? Is that
the Green Investment Bank is part of that. The Investment Bank is more about new industries in environmental technologies, and Bristol's quite well placed for some of those, actually. So I mean, I think we do need to have that process of differentiation, and I think we need to grow up a bit about our politics and accept that you know, there are going to be strands that come from different parties in a coalition, whether it's this coalition or possibly a future one, and that you don't have to own all your partner's policies. And I think this is obviously taking some time to bed in. The other thing I would say with regard to the local elections is that they don't four necessarily for the whole country at a particular time. And this year and last year, they were heavily weighted towards cities, and particularly the north of England. And one of the difficulties I think we've had in facing those elections is that as being part of a coalition, the Conservatives in many northern cities don't exist. They don't have councillors to lose. And so the brunt of any criticism is on us. Plus the fact that, you know, the electoral cycle is such, these were last four years ago, Gordon Brown's government was very unpopular, and we made a lot of gains that, you know, are now going back the other way.
So what about the, also another interesting little result today is the election for the first time of respect councillors up in Bradford, and I think this is possibly the first, and we will see this happening more in deprived areas, maybe in the north, maybe in other parts of the country. But I mean, surely what the electorate are saying is they're echoing what George Galloway was saying earlier. We heard him saying, is ultimately that the main three political parties simply aren't listening to ordinary people.
I don't see much coherence from Respect actually at the moment. I mean,
they're anti-cuts. That's one of the only people who are actually saying there should not be any cuts.
Anti-cuts, and then what? That's the problem. Apart from rather vacuous slogans about making rich people pay, as if the problem is, you know,
but you don't think that, do you? You've been involved in this latest budget, which is actually reducing. Your party has been involved in reducing the budget reducing the income tax for the highest paid.
And I think we've made it clear that, and I think we've got to make it clear that the budget was a package, and essentially we got our relief for the lowest paid, and in return, you know, this was a clear Conservative priority, and I think that was clear. I was at our party conference back in March in Gateshead, and it was very clear that, you know, if we got the progress we wanted at the bottom end of the tax scale, then there would be a quid pro quo further up. I think that there is that. I'm not sure that 5% is necessarily the difference, but there is possible moves on things like mansion tax, tycoon tax, and so on. I think we've got to make sure, what I would like to see is, rather than get involved in discussions about percentages of tax, I'd actually like to see that the tax that's owed is paid.
But don't you think it makes the electorate angry when they see that, you know, the rich are getting richer? It comes across as a government by the millionaires for the millionaires.
Well, I think a lot of the problem with taxation is actually corporate taxation. And we cannot, as a nation, have any credibility on corporate taxation when half the tax havens in the world are British dependent territories.
But a lot of that is private income that's been put into these tax havens, isn't it?
Well, a lot of it is, but a lot of it's corporate income as well. And you have to say that Gordon Brown, in his years as Chancellor and then subsequently Prime Minister, he had the opportunity to reform that and chose not to. So I think if we're making some moves in that direction, then that's fine. What I would say about Respect is that, you know, I don't see any coherence apart from, you know, a knee-jerk protest. And knee-jerk protest happens. I mean, we saw a few years ago the knee-jerk protest of choice in a lot of areas where people were voting for the BNP. And we're now seeing, you know, the BNP are starting to lose seats.
Well, I think, you know, Respect are very closely connected with the trade union movement. And so I think when journalists are sacked at the Evening Post, it's not mainstream political parties that turn up to do a protest. It's Respect to protest, because that they can see that slowly things like, the way that our society is able to discuss things are slowly being eroded. Anyway, we're joined now also by Craig Clark. Hi, Craig.
Hello there.
Now, you want to be a mayoral candidate potentially. Anyway, that's what you were saying last week. What's your view today?
Well, just want to say, first of all, big thank you to everybody who decided to get out there and request for change. It's quite interesting to see 5,000 more people voted yes than no. I didn't manage to get to vote, unfortunately, myself, because I was slightly late, unfortunately, and at 10:02 they wouldn't allow me to vote. So thank you for doing that.
So what do you think of the result? You're obviously quite pleased.
I couldn't be happier.
Right.
I've just got off the phone to the chairman of the Peace Party, John Morris, and I've got to obviously submit now the papers to hopefully become the Peace Party candidate.
But are you any wiser than Steve as to what the mayor's powers will be? Because this is part of the problem, is people were voting in this referendum yesterday and we're not even being told exactly what those powers are going
to
be.
Did you read my letter to David Cameron outlining exactly that? No? Well, if you actually look on the council website, you'll see as a public statement last week at the cabinet meeting, I've outlined In hopefully quite a humorous way, the way in which I would like to see the future of Bristol happen if I was lucky enough to be elected as mayor.
Well, we've also got the elections for the council leader, Steve. Who are your tips for the top? Can you give us a couple of, as a bit of a pundit, who might we see in a couple of weeks' time leading the city for your party?
Well, I mean, that's a two-part question, isn't it? I mean, the election on Tuesday night is who is to lead the Liberal Democrats. The question then is whether the Liberal Democrats will have the minority administration in the city. In terms of the Liberal Democrat race...
Can you just explain the difference? I'm finding myself a bit puzzled by that.
Well, essentially, all political parties on the council elect their leaders on an annual basis, or four political parties. We have no overall majority. When you have overall majority, then usually when someone's elected party leader, then it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to end up as leader of the council. When you don't have an overall majority, then for somebody to end up as leader of the council, then either somebody else has to vote for them or abstain, so that the vote carries. Liberal Democrats are the largest single party on the council. So that's what may happen now in terms of the Lib Dem leadership race. There are two declared candidates at the moment. That's Dr. John Rogers and Guy Pulteney. There may well be others in due course. The nominations, as I said, close tomorrow.
Are they from the Yes camp or the No camp, the Liberal Democrats? Do you know?
John Rogers was definitely in the No camp. Guy Pulteney, I'm not sure.
Not sure, okay.
I think he was in the No camp.
But I'm just guessing that
Guy Pulteney was going to stand. Mm. So I would assume he's a yes. Well, that's what he said to me. I'll just go on what the people say.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly going to stand for group leader. Well, he's going to stand for mayor as well. I don't know.
Well,
he hasn't been asked to declare that. So.
In his words to me, he would be the youngest mayor to be elected ever. So, you know, he's a very good guy. I think you should back him.
What are your thoughts, Craig, on George Ferguson? He's the guy. It's quite clear. The Evening Post has decided.
I don't mind. Apparently, he's going to give us £3 million, isn't it, to Stan?
Well, certainly he's going to be cutting. Quite clearly, he's going to be.
No, I read that as he's paying £3 million to Stan.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, the way you see these headlines? I will save £3 million, or I will cut £3 million. What does he really mean, Steve?
It's easy. He's just going to pay the £3 million. He's got it. He can just pay the £3 million. That's how he saves us £3 million in 1 year.
Well, that's not what it says here at all.
No, but that's how he could do it.
What are your thoughts, though, Steve, about the sort of terminology here? And, you know, this is saving £3 million or cutting £3 million?
Well, one person's save is another person's cut, isn't it? I mean, it very much depends. Generally, if it's something you don't want to go, then you call it a cut. If it's something you're not bothered about, you call it a saving. So, I mean, I think... you know, that's very much where it comes from. Having said that, I mean, we know what central government budgets are going. I mean, I think the council's had to save something like 70 or cut 70 million from its budget over 3 years. Now, a lot of that has been through loss of staff, non-filling of posts, as I said earlier, axing of posts and so on, and a certain amount of streamlining of IT and all the rest of it. What we've tried to do is maintain frontline services, and I think we've done that in Bristol. Places like Gloucestershire and Somerset have closed libraries and so on, and Bristol hasn't.
What about care homes, day centres, things like that?
How long you can carry that on of not cutting things, we'll see. Well, as far as care homes are concerned, I mean, there's a big consultation exercise on that, which is about to start. And will run for the next few weeks. And there are issues with that, obviously, that council owns a number of residential homes that are old, not fit for purpose, and not fully occupied. And that's a very expensive way of providing services.
We can help with that because we've already said that we can offer free labour to the council to do up your properties.
But, Craig, these elections later in the year, who do you think are going to be... I mean, obviously, you've certainly declared that your intention is to stand.
Yeah.
Who are some of the other potential candidates, other than George Ferguson, that we keep hearing about?
We don't need it. I'm putting out now that... You know, if George Ferguson wants to be in the cabinet, he's welcome. So is Barbara Jenks.
Hang on, but he's not a councillor. Surely he has to be a councillor before he can be in the cabinet.
He's got £3 million in his pocket. If he puts that up to, say, for example, the Wallace and Gromit appeal for the new children's stuff, thank you. I went up the Wills Tower this week. They're looking to raise Obviously, to get the kids' hospital right up to up to scratch, if he's willing to put £3 million into that project, he can be in the cabinet.
No, hang on a minute, because I'm getting a bit nervous. It sounds to me like you're saying that if you've got a lot of money, you can run the city. You know,
isn't that the case?
It sounds almost like already? You know, we're going to be in the situation where it's...
I don't think it is the case already. Because
really?
Because we have a system of
so you're telling me that.
Hang on, Craig. Let's finish.
I mean, I was in the cabinet. I'm not a wealthy individual. The two potential leadership candidates I spoke to aren't wealthy individuals. We stand for election and we win or lose elections in our various wards, and so it's not the case that somebody can buy their way in, as they can in American politics, for instance.
Well,
so,
talking of American politics, we've seen quite a lot of changes, haven't we, over the last few years. This mayoral thing is very much a sort of on the American model. Also, the laws reform starts to look like we're going to have a sort of two elected houses system, like they have in the United States, with the House of Commons and House of Lords both elected, like the Congress and the House of Representatives. Is this a good way to go, Craig?
I have no idea.
I'm a little bit worried about it.
I think it is a good way to go. I think you have to be careful with things like timing and terms and so on. But a lot of countries that have you either have a two-chamber system or you don't. I think there is merit in a two-chamber system and having a revising chamber that can look at laws going through. And I prefer an elected system. I think you need to be elected on a different basis, on a different mandate. But certainly places like Germany and Italy and so on, where they have, in France, where they have the Senate and the House of Representatives, I think works quite well. And I would want to see. I wouldn't want to see the American model where the electorate for Senate biases against urban areas. I think that is wrong. So I would like to see that done probably regionally.
Well, one of the big changes that there's been over the last 20, 30 years was pointed out by MP Dennis Skinner this week on Russia Today, and he was interviewed by Laura Smith. So let's have a listen to that.
There's a lot of people that have been political advisers of one kind or another, and that's growing as each parliament goes by. You've got a lot more lawyers. We've got the biggest snob of all time now in Cameron running the roost. The snobs are there to be seen on the Tory benches in particular. I call it Millionaire's Row.
Dennis Skinner's an MP who would once have been seen as pure traditional British Labour Party stock. The son of a miner and an ex-miner himself, he came up through the ranks, became a trade union leader, a councillor and then a Labour Party MP in 1970. It's a route into politics that's become almost obsolete, replaced by a career path through top universities into special advisor posts and from there into ministerial jobs. That's how Ed Miliband, the leader of the party in which the core support base was once the working classes, got his job. 30 years ago, 40% of Labour MPs came from manual or clerical jobs, compared with just 9% today. There's been a real reduction in the number of MPs who have first-hand experience of the trials and tribulations of working class families.
That was Laura Smith there on Russia Today, talking with Dennis Skinner, particularly about Labour MPs. But the truth is the truth for many MPs, Steve, isn't it? That actually nowadays there's less people who have long experience in ordinary jobs, this kind of thing. That a lot of them just tend to be lawyers or political advisors of one sort or another.
Well, I think Dennis Skinner makes actually a very valid point, and he's talking particularly about his party, but I think it actually goes throughout. I mean, even the Conservatives in days gone by, you know, they were often people who came from businesses or came from the services or whatever. And one of the problems that I perceive now, I mean, when I first got involved in politics, I was 18, it wasn't something you made as a career choice now. But what I now see from people is that, you know, they do politics at university, they then go and work as an intern, and you know, they work for an MP, they join a PR firm, and really it's all inside that little Westminster.
That sounds like your leader, Nick Clegg, by the way.
Well, it's actually the three party leaders. It's actually Cameron, Clegg and Miliband have all come from this very Westminster, you know, very bubble existence. Nick Clegg less so, because he was at least in Brussels for part of it. But I think it is getting very incestuous, and I think it is a problem. And it's also compounding this Westminster centric view of politics. Whereas I think,
well, it's interesting you bring up Westminster, because I was hoping you might agree with me on this. What Have you seen Westminster's council tax figures?
Oh, the borough of Westminster?
Yeah.
Not recently.
Okay, have a look, because you'll find that they're at least half as much as they are in Bristol. Mm. So I would like to challenge Westminster directly to try to provide the council tax at a level beating Westminster's, because I think that that would attract people to Bristol to live and work and pay those taxes, because they're the cheapest and the best value for money in the country. And I'm hoping that Bristol people will get behind this project, because we could quite easily do it. Because if Westminster can do it, why can't we?
Yeah, why not, Steve?
Well, Westminster benefits from being, you know, having the West End of London and it's in its catchment area. So therefore, on things like parking charges, for instance, you know, and entertainment licences, councils raise money in a number of ways. There's government grant.
Yeah, but hang on a minute.
No, let him finish. Craig,
there's
just
government
let him finish
grant, there's council tax, and there's charges. Now, if you're Westminster, your ability to raise money in charges for parking, licences for restaurants, theatres and so on, is vastly greater than Bristol. And all these things are currently taken into account. And Bristol's level of council tax is actually at a low compared to where it was 10 or 12 years ago.
But that's not actually true. In Westminster, you can park anywhere you like, because there's parking available, because they've introduced a system where you can't even use cash. You can only use your phone to register and your credit card to actually park in Westminster. What that's done is allowed the people who live there, who get permits, to park outside their houses in Westminster. Now, you're telling me that they're paying less for their council tax by a half and they get to park outside their own house for free.
OK, you've had your say there, Craig, and let's just leave it at that, because they're actually quite different. Westminster is rather different to here. Let's just look at some of the news this week, particularly about in Argentina and Bolivia. They're starting to nationalise things, particularly there's a story here from The Guardian. While Europe forces yet more privatisation on Greece and Spain under the Orwellian name of liberalisation, Latin America in 2012 is challenging the orthodox view that private is always better than public. On the 1st of May, Bolivia seized the Spanish company that controls its electricity grid, just after Argentina effectively renationalised its main oil company, expropriating 51% owned by Spanish firm Repsol. So look, this seems like they're bucking the trend in Latin America, Steve. There's actually some massive nationalisations been going on quietly behind the scenes. Certainly it's not been really trumpeted from the rooftops, has it? But they've decided that they're fed up with their resources.
What a great idea.
Profits being made from their resources in their country being suddenly or just simply shipped abroad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds good. The danger is, if you're not careful, it lends you into a slippery slope of protectionism.
Well, the Spanish got very excited and very upset, but there's not really much they can do. I mean, this sort of nationalisation. I mean, for example, we've got the French companies controlling a lot of our electricity industry. You know, various other foreign interests making money out of British infrastructure and then shipping that money abroad.
This is what I'm trying to sort of get people to understand again. They created privatisation. It was nationalised, and then they privatised it. So, by definition, you can unprivatise it and nationalise it back if you wish.
See, this does seem like it's almost like David Cameron.
It's a cycle.
The privatisation that David Cameron's doing at the moment, the big one, of course, is allowing private industry into the NHS. It does seem as if this is just sorting this stuff out for his mates.
Well, the bigger privatiser. In actual fact, I mean, I think there's probably more privatisation done by Tony Blair than done by any government before or since. But the difficulty with this is that, in the short term it sounds fine. In the end, you end up with retaliatory action, and if you're not careful, your markets for your goods and services start to dry up. So I think it's certainly of interest to see how this develops, but I can't see it actually going anywhere outside possibly the confines of Latin America. I mean, if European countries started doing it, then we'd end up with siege economy, tariff boundary, and everything would start grinding to a halt.
Why is that?
No trade.
Why is that? I mean, ultimately, this is just about nationalising infrastructure, isn't it? This is about governments saying we are taking back over control of the railways, for example. There's a massive public support for that kind of thing, for railway renationalisation.
Well, there's public support for
for taking back railways, but the difficulty you've got, it's where you start from. Because for many years, we were hampered with the rail privatisation of the 1940s by the amount of compensation that had to be paid to the shareholders that it was
nationalised. I'm afraid the Argentinians have drawn the line here, a little bit like the Icelandic government. Well, they're saying no compensation, we're just having it, because what you're doing is against the law now. We've just changed the law in this country.
Absolutely. That's what I keep trying to get people to understand. That's why you vote. But they vote to make changes in law that then have to be honoured.
Okay, Steve.
But Argentina also defaulted on its debts a few years ago, and it's fine. You can make these changes, but sometimes it's not immediately clear what the long-term consequences are. And I'm not sure it is with here. You could end up that Argentina can't sell its goods on the world market, and they've controlled their resources, but they've got no money coming into the country.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Another interesting thing this week. Looks like, if you believe the Evening Post, the Post headline, the row with First Group could see the council take over the buses. Now, that sounds like a kind of quasi-nationalisation, Steve. What's going on here? The bus operator First, we're told, their stranglehold on Bristol's bus services could soon be at an end.
Well, it could, and there is what's called quality contracts, which Tim Kent's letter was about. Tim Kent, the executive member for transport on the council at the moment.
It's just changing.
We have an annual meeting coming up on the 15th, and all sorts of things can change. But Tim is this year's, and I think that this is an interesting one. It's clearly driven by the fact that First are playing according to the rules, but not within the spirit of the rules, and that they're often given very short notices of what services they want to run on bank holidays and this sort of thing. And I think what this is saying is that if we can't get a better understanding from the major operator, then we may have to look at going down this what's called quality contract route.
Well,
it's a long-term process.
It sounds like about time too.
Why can't we do something really easy that they've done in London? Why can't we give the free transport to kids up to 18? Because it's worked in London.
Steve?
It's brilliant.
Well, it comes down to cost.
Hang on.
It does come down to cost. We looked at doing things.
The buses are still going in the same direction.
For 16-year-olds, yes, but the bus companies will insist on the fare being paid by somebody, either by the passenger or by someone on their behalf.
I want to ask the people whether they mind paying. I don't mind paying. For kids to go for free on the public transport in Bristol will help. It's helped in London.
Well, I'll tell you who could possibly pay. That's First shareholders. Before we finish, another story. Thames Water have been accused of mismanagement by closing 24 reservoirs. This is the General Municipal and Boilermakers, GMB, Gary Smith talking in the Daily Telegraph. Basically, he's saying that 25 bulk water storage facilities have been closed by Thames Water. This is, I suppose, maybe an explanation as to why we've had 180 flood warnings in the south of England, and yet we're being told that I'm afraid you've got to carry on with the hosepipe ban. Craig, quickly.
Yeah, basically, that's a really interesting story. I'll be looking into that because that makes
Steve?
Me laugh.
Steve, what is going on?
Well, clearly there is a problem with management, and I've always been surprised when you get water mains go, how long it takes them to actually put it right. I don't think we can serve. I think the problem is, in the past, we've had quite heavy rainfall in this country, and I think we've got used to that, and we're not doing what we should do to conserve water, as countries in the Mediterranean, for instance, where it's in shorter supply, naturally do. I think it's about time we looked at it.
You're saying we should be thinking about nationalising our water supply again, going back to the old water boards?
Certainly making it not for profit.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea, surely, is we get our infrastructure and we supply it at cost. Anyway, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guests, Craig Clark and Lib Dem Councillor for Eastfield, Steve Comer. After the news, was peddling the WMD lie and then sacking the journalist and the Director General just business as usual at the BBC?
Station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.